Well, our normal practice as a church is to work systematically through the Bible, but we vary that from time to time, and the summer is a good opportunity for us to do that. I thought these next few Sundays we would take a slightly different tack through the Scriptures. This time of year, many people take the opportunity to go away and visit somewhere exotic on holiday, perhaps to soak up the sun or visit the sights or whatever. But of course, not all of us have the chance to do that for various reasons. If that's the case, I have good news for you. The Bible will take you to these places without you ever needing to leave the comfort of your new Surrey Chapel chair. Even better, as well as giving us a taste of these exotic places, we will discover that each of these locations have a part to play in the biblical story. There are spiritual lessons to learn through considering the place these particular locations have in Scripture. What we have to learn is far more relevant than anything you will hear from your Saga Holidays tour guide or Club 1830 courier. So open up your backpacker's Bible. We're going to be starting in Genesis. If you want to see the pyramids and discover the significance of Egypt, come next Sunday, and where we can leave our children all week long for holiday club. After that, we're going to take a trip to the Holy Land itself, and later on, we're going to visit the rest of the world all in one go, the ends of the earth, as the Bible calls them. But we begin in the place of the beginnings. We're beginning in a place where you would not choose to visit today unless you are a very adventurous tourist indeed. The modern nation of Iraq is not a common tourist destination. And we all know why. Iraq is not a natural country, as it were. Its boundaries were set up in the imperial carve-up after the First World War. It was ruled for decades later on in the 20th century by this jovial fellow here, this charmer. Initially, of course, supported by Western nations in a savage war against Iran, and then, of course, opposed and deposed in a huge and costly war. The nation of Iraq now struggles to hold together, riven by ethnic and religious strife, and the historic population is either in exile, or this is the downfall of Saddam, of course. And the historic Christian population is now either in exile or deeply persecuted, as you can see. This is probably one of the most dangerous parts of the world for Westerners to visit. You would not go there on holiday. But that was not so necessarily in biblical times. In fact, the Bible takes us to Babylonia, as it calls it, not once, but three significant times in history. And the first of these is in the very much at the beginning of the Bible, the book of Genesis. Babylonia has been called the cradle of human civilization. So come with me now to the book of Genesis, chapter 11. Now, these events here take place in what we might call time immemorial. They're in the order of thousands of years BC, but my understanding is you can't put an exact, precise time and date upon what we're reading here. What would we see, though, if we went back in those times to this particular place? Well, not a baking desert, as we would see now, but a vast and fertile plain, embraced by these two huge rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. We would see swarms of workmen busying themselves in the fields with their oxen, the caravans of pack animals passing to and fro on the roads between the lush crops. And ahead of you, rising from the plain on a vast mound, we would see a city. And there at its center, already reaching to the sky, is the beginnings of a tower. Workmen scurry like ants upon the scaffold as bricks are hauled up to them. Smoke rises from kilns all around the edge of the city as they devote their energies to the production of bricks. The Bible records these days like this in Genesis chapter 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, otherwise Babylonia, and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." So this is the biblical story about the beginning of human civilization in its fullest and most completely worked out sense. Obviously, there had been building projects and so on before this, back in the age of the flood, but there's nothing quite on this scale and with this agenda. All humanity focused on its way, in this way, upon this particular task. And for all the wonders of human endeavour that have followed, there has been nothing quite like it ever since. People have never got together in quite this way, united as one. And the reason for that is that God has not allowed it. Read on a bit. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That's why it is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. You see, this great effort of the men of Babel was fundamentally flawed. It was, in fact, fundamentally wicked. This was an attempt by humanity to achieve divinity in its own right, and it could not be allowed to achieve its goal. So God himself thwarted it. And so nothing of this great tower of Babel remained, except a memory. After Babel, the earliest fully developed civilizations known to archaeologists now, great cities with names like Kish and Nippur and Ur, grew up in this part of the world. These cities are now nothing but mounds in the desert, if this will work. The archaeologists have unearthed the foundations of the city of Ur here. The building in the background is a modern reconstruction. But in their day, these cities were the center of the earth, and in them huge ziggurats reached to the sky in memory of that great tower. And if we visited at just the right time, about 2000 BC, and just the right place, this great city of Ur, we might meet a man named Abram as he walked through the city gates with his home and family, laden on donkeys and camels, following a call from God to leave. The Lord said to Abraham, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you." So that's the first place that Babylon features strongly in the Bible. But let's move on, because the Bible lets us travel in space, time as well, space and time as well. We now can be much more precise about the era that we are going to visit. It's going to be 586 BC by our reckoning. Now, we need to think of Babylon now as being a huge, sprawling city in ancient terms. It's a city with mighty walls. I think we have a picture here. This is what remains of some of Babylon's walls. Wide enough to ride a four-horse chariot along the top. And a vast palace gleams in the center. And alongside it, So the legend goes anyway, one of the ancient wonders of the world. This is a picture, imagining it, drawn by an artist in the 16th century, I think. The glorious hanging gardens of Babylon. And on every street corner of this city, we would see a face, a statue. One name standing out above them all. That name is, of course, Nebuchadnezzar. The old Neo-Babylonian empire had risen from the dust. And under this great emperor and his predecessors had become the greatest city of the known world. But it's not happened out of the blue. God has been at work. Now, in the mid part of the Bible, in the later Old Testament, Babylon plays an even more key role in the events. God raised up the Babylonians, though they were an evil nation, as agents of his judgment against his own unfaithful people. We find that spelled out in many places, both in the history and the prophets. Let's take just one example from a place where we don't often look, the book of the prophet Habakkuk. Well, it ought to be a prize for the first people to find it. And I haven't even marked it myself. Here we are. Page 940 in your chapel Bibles. One of those little minor prophets, as they are called, only because their books are shorter than the others. This prophet, like many of the others, was outraged and despairing at the depths to which God's people had sunk as a nation. He's crying out to God for an answer. How can you be letting this happen? And this is God's reply in verse 5. Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if I told you, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people, who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. And it continues in a similar vein. God would raise up this wicked nation to be his agent of judgment, not just of the surrounding nations, but also his own people, Israel. And true enough, this is what happened. In a series of invasions, the Babylonians eventually invaded and conquered all of Israel and Judah. They destroyed their temple, they humbled their king, and they exiled many of Israel's people. If in our grand tour of Babylon we visited the slums and the back streets, we would find a small community of Jewish exiles, quietly and humbly living their lives as political refugees, working hard as citizens, yet retaining their own cultural identity and faith, bearing this chastisement from God in expectation that one day he would bring them home. And that's a promise he would keep, of course. The evil Neo-Babylonian Empire would not last long. For a while, those wicked people were agents of God's wrath, but very soon they too would be judged for what they had done. As the prophets had foretold, Habakkuk, Isaiah, and Jeremiah, Babylon would come and then go. And of course, that's what happened at the hands of the Persians. Babylon was never again to rise as a world power. But that is not the end of Babylon in the Bible. There's one more place in the Bible where Babylon features in depth. And that, of course, is at the very end. Turn in your Bible to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 to 6. Now, here, of course, the Bible uses symbolic language. We're not here talking about a literal city. Nonetheless, listen to how Babylon features. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came down and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the world were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held up a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. Now, this, of course, is symbolic language, as I said, not talking about a literal city anymore. But what we find in the Bible is that Babylon has come to stand for, if you like, all the wickedness of a godless world. So she is pictured as a prostitute, one who sells herself for money. She's characterized by adultery and blasphemy, by self-indulgence, by drunkenness, by persecution of the righteous. In short, Babylon becomes the figure representing all human self-aggrandizement and gratification in opposition to God. She is what we call the world, meaning the sum total of corporate human effort directed against what is good and right, directed against God. So I hope you can see now how that Old Testament background of Babylon has been worked upon and developed to give us this picture of the whole world. Human beings conspiring to be like God, to replace God, to do without him, to build their own tower to heaven, to conquer God's people and destroy their temple and set up their own God instead. What was once represented by a great tower or a great city dominating the world is now in fact an invisible power dominating the globalized world in which we live. So we read in verse 18, "The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth." That's what Babylon has come. And that explains why you and I can't go and visit Babylon anymore. We can't go and visit them. It's not because political developments in Iraq have made it too dangerous to go to that part of the world. The reason that we can't go and visit Babylon is that we already live there. That's where we live now. Our world is now the culmination of the Tower of Babel, of the Empire of Babylon. We already live in a world dominated by money. Look at the descriptions that come later of Babylon in chapter 18. We haven't got time to read them. But see how much Babylon has got to do with economics. We live in a world dominated by self-serving powers behind the thrones of our world. We live in a world dominated by material greed, by self-indulgent urges out of anyone's control. We live in a world where restraint is scorned, where sacred and precious things are to be sneered at and derided, where getting instant gratification for your desires is the norm, and where our answer to the world's problems is so often to have another drink, so to speak, and silence those who speak the truth. That is not totally the case, of course, because the grace and the mercy of God hold back the worst of human nature and allow good and right to still be seen alongside in the world that we live. Yet the fact is, Babylon is growing in her influence. God is having to do more and more to hold her back, if you like. On our screens and in our politics and finances. In the generally God-denying, self-aggrandizing tendencies of our age. We don't have to go to Babylon for a visit. We already live there and see her glories. So welcome to Babylon, everyone. What are we to do then? Well, if we are Christians, Peter puts it this way. We are to be strangers in the world. In the world, but not of the world. That's how Jesus puts it himself. We live here in Babylon now, but we don't belong. Our status is as those passing through. What does that mean in practice? Well, Jeremiah gave some good instructions back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar to the Jewish exiles who lived in Babylon in his day. He wrote them a letter in Jeremiah chapter 29. Just listen as I read to you. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I've carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. That's interesting, isn't it? And see, likewise, as believers, we are to conduct normal life in our own part of modern Babylon. By which I mean, we don't have to live in a way that is hostile, a way that is visibly alien. We're not to be physically separate. We need not set ourselves up as monks and weirdos meeting in churches with no windows. But we must remember that we do not belong here anymore. We must live as people always ready to move on from this place without loss or regret in our minds. Jeremiah goes on to say this to the exiles. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I've banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile. Likewise, you see, God has better things, a better place in store for us than anything life in this place can offer. Or in other words, and if you want to take away from this a summary of the message, this is Babylon. Live here, but do not get too attached to it. That's the summary, if you like. Babylon, don't get attached. Don't get attached to life in Babylon, for her time of judgment will come. We have to recognize that although the biblical picture of Babylon, addressing its spiritual side, if you like, it paints a pretty dire picture. It shows us what the spiritual nature of Babylon is. But we also have to remember that on the ground, Babylon is actually quite a nice place to live. Abraham was a whole lot more comfortable in the villas of Ur than he ever was in the tents in Canaan. The Jews were a whole lot more comfortable in Babylon as exiles than they were if they left Babylon and moved back to the rubble and the hard life of Jerusalem. Likewise, in our own experience, life in Babylon offers benefits. For all its failings, there is much to enjoy in a modern Western lifestyle. It is nice. That's why so many aspire to it. Material riches and pleasures and security, sexual liberty and easy entertainment. The good life is on offer, and even when it doesn't actually deliver, there's always that tantalizing possibility that it might tomorrow, which is actually what keeps most people going. John puts the warning very pithily. Do not love the world, he says, or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of the sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. Or we could say from Babylon. But it's not just about obvious sin as well. It's all too easy to settle down in this place and become residents, not transients, settlers, not travelers. And we can spot this in our own priorities. Look at how many times in the last year some minor obligation or duty or pleasure of Babylon, of this world, has taken precedence over some spiritual duty or opportunity or privilege. Consider that in your own experience. Are we saying it's always wrong to miss a church service or a prayer meeting because something else has come along? Well, no, we're not, because Christians, we are free to make our choices. But what does it say when again and again and again our attachments to this world, to this life, are constantly prioritized over our commitments and our calling to the next? What does it say? What does it say if Babylon always trumps your affection to Christ? So the warning is, remember what's left of that first Babylon. The piles of broken pottery and rubble, a few foundations under the sand. Remember what's left of Nebuchadnezzar's great and glorious capital. Likewise. And remember what will be left of the Babylon where we now dwell. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird." Then the mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, "With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again." And if we're to be faithful for Jesus, we must be always ready for verse 4. "Then I heard another voice come from heaven and say, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes.'" So, there you have it. The Backpacker's Bible Guide to Babylon. The place where human civilization began, in a way, and first ever tried to usurp God. The place where one of the most evil empires of this world tried to crush God and destroy his people. And a figure for where we live now. A world that looks so good, so tasty, yet all the time is campaigning against God, and one day will fall. And yes, you can visit, because you already live here. But do not stay. The real question is whether you can ever leave.